Okay, now let's get started. John, first, I just have to ask, how do you keep up this pace?
Well, I think that when you're passionate about what you do, it's easy. This is not a job for me. Passion, it's something that I do naturally. I've often said that an entrepreneur works 18 hours a day to keep from getting a job. And I define success and redefine success as going from failure to failure without loss of enthusiasm. And you should never, ever, ever give up. When I was growing up in the inner city in Compton, California, in South Central LA, I was told by the banker who came in my classroom to teach financial literacy that the way to build wealth was the magic of compounded interest. Problem was, I didn't have any money. And as I joked with some employees earlier today, we were so poor, we didn't have an OR in the end. We were just po. It's not totally true. We actually we did okay, but we lived in a low wealth neighborhood. My point is, we didn't have excess capital to invest, not financial capital. So I just redefined it in my life and in my mind. I said, well, if I can't benefit from the magic of compounded interest, then I'm gonna benefit from the magic of compounded hustle. So my mission in life was to succeed based on outworking, outthinking, out innovating everyone else. That when you're sleeping, I would be working. I would say it's a hustler with a purpose. So it's the magic of compounded hustle. It's working for something larger and more important than yourself. Never, ever, 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 ever giving up. And it just sort of feeds on itself. And when you're doing something like that, it energizes you. People have to remind me that I'm working and have to ask me to stop because it just comes so naturally.
That's great. Your energy is just very impressive. I've watched you all day today as we spent much of the day together, and the way you're able to continuously inspire people, words and with your actions, is wonderful to observe. I'm taking notes.
Oh, well, I think you're doing just fine, Tom.
Well, your book has been a source of inspiration to so many people. Can you share just briefly how you arrived at the tenets that you use for Love Leadership?
Sure. If I had to rename this book over, I might say My Own Crushing Failure. Call it My Own Story of Insecurity. I might say it's my own travel of vanity. I might say my own debates with fear. That rainbows only follow storms. You cannot have a rainbow without a storm first. You guys know a lot about that here in Florida. So it was me overcoming my fears, overcoming my insecurities. One of the quotes I love best in this book, my favorite chapter is Loss Creates Leaders. But the quote that I love the best is that courage is nothing more than your faith reaching through your fear, displaying itself as action. We don't love because of, we love in spite of. If we love because of, we wouldn't love anybody. We might not even love ourselves, in spite of the fact that people are insecure, in spite of the fact that people are selfish and self-centered and don't treat ourselves sometimes all that well. And so I think that it was my own personal story. Probably the defining moments, of course, when I was 10 years old, started my own business. When I was 5 years of age, my mom and dad divorced over one cause of divorce in America is money. When I was an actor in my teenage years, I wasn't all that good, by the way. Became too impressed with myself and was homeless 6 months of my life when I was 18. Now, once you go through all that, by the time you're 18, nothing much can stop you. If you get through that, Fred Smith in the book says that the whole key to life and successful living is managing pain. The pain you create for yourself and the pain visited upon you by others. So increasingly, I've defined leadership as how you respond to crisis. And so I've become stronger because of my ability to respond to challenges and issues and being able to admit that I'm not perfect. And that's okay. None of us are perfect. That's okay too. And becoming sort of comfortable in your own skin and knowing that that's a good thing.
Great, thanks. Many of our viewers tonight are students in college, and while they may be at various stages of their lives, one of those things that many of us say is, gee, if I had only known then what I know now, what do you wish you would have known when you were at college age?
Wow, I was about to say the youth is wasted on the young, but
Isn't it though?
I think that the thing that hits me when you say that, I'm gonna go back to what I would have named this book had it not been Love, Leadership, the New World. I think that if I had known then that I know now that it's okay to be me, that you're enough all by yourself. As my pastor, Reverend Murray, would say, is not what people call you, it's what you answer to that's important. I add to argue with a fool proves there are two, or as Quincy Jones, mentor who's in the book, would say, not 1 ounce of my self-esteem depends on your acceptance of me. That leadership is not a popularity contest. That I'd rather you respect me and learn to like me than like me and never respect me. So to not be afraid to be out on the point all by yourself. Not be afraid to walk the road less traveled, Scott Peck's book. To not be afraid to have a belief and a system and a vision, maybe out of sync with the rest of the world. It may mean you're a visionary, because egos don't fly in packs. And I think that getting comfortable with that has been my lifelong struggle. Not, wanting to fit in, wanting to be the popular kid, which I wasn't. I mean, I was a tackling dummy in high school. My mother put me in these crushed velvet. I'm traumatized as I'm thinking about it. Purple velour suits with these ruffled shirt and a big bow tie, and sent me to school at 10 years of age, Tom. I love her, but I wanted to
South
strangle her.
Central,
In
huh?
South, and this was in Compton, worse.
Wow.
And
Oh, I know it well. I lived in North Long Beach for a long time, just blocks
now
from Compton,
that's where
so.
all the cute girls are.
Yeah.
That's where the popular. That's where I lived in the hood. They say
Yeah.
the
Oh,
hood. So I mean, on a serious note, I think that it was those purportedly traumatizing experiences. So because I wasn't popular, I got my put my head. Because I wasn't popular, I didn't have the opportunity to go out and be distracted. So I was focused on becoming a businessman. And I started wearing suits and started seeing that businessmen wore suits, and I went case, and I started my first business when I was 10. So it's no miracle that I'm an entrepreneur today. Dad was an entrepreneur, and I saw entrepreneurs and I wanted to be one. That's why I think the power of role modeling is so incredible. And I would encourage students who are looking at this show to not get distressed and overwhelmed because in this moment they are unhappy or frustrated. That's just part of life. You can't grow without legitimate suffering. Embrace it. Embrace legitimate suffering and it'll make you stronger.
Advice. You've been an advisor to multiple U.S. presidents, and I know many of us are curious about some of the lessons you learned from serving in a capacity as an advisor to presidents. I assume they weren't the only ones learning, although I'm sure they learned a lot from you. What did you learn from that experience?
I'm smiling because I've had the honor of working with President Clinton, working with President Bush, President Barack Obama, who is a great man, and dealing with some unprecedented times right now. I think the thing, the reason I'm smiling is the first thing I learned is that they don't listen a lot.
Was that a surprise?
It was a surprise that the White House, every White House, not I'm not talking about any particular White House. Doesn't necessarily listen. So you've got to be pithy. You got to be able to talk succinctly. I mean, a White House email is a line in 2 words maximum.
Twitter, huh?
You get into oh no, Twitter is a long.
Too long,
That's a
huh?
paragraph. You get into a paragraph or two, and you've lost them. They are moving at Mach speed. So you got to make
Wow.
your point, make it fast. If they say, an old saying, if there's an end to this story, can you please start there? You've got to make it really relevant to the president. If the mayor can handle it, it's not the president's deal. If the governor can handle it, it's not the president's deal. Anybody else can handle it, it's not the president's deal. It really has to be relevant to a national agenda. I think the first thing is that they don't always listen, but I never gave up. And in one particular case I'm thinking about, it took me 7 years to get an idea through. But I'm so glad I stuck with it. I think the other thing is that they're all good people. I mean, they mean well. They want the best for America. Some of them underwhelm you, some of them fail miserably, some of them shoot through the moon, but they all mean well. I mean, when I hear people rooting for the president's failure, I just think that that's just that you're winning battles and you're losing wars. You're rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. When your president succeeds, you succeed, and when your president fails, you fail. So I think that's that fear-based leadership thing. I think
Yeah.
that that's you know, fear is a punk, and fear is lazy, and fear is about what we're against and not what we're for. It's really easy to be in the criticism business. What I say to folks is I like what the president is doing much better than what you're not doing. So I just encourage people to get in the game and be part of the solution and make America great again. I mean, that's what we want, and that's going to come through legitimate suffering and constructive friction. And I'll make my answer shorter.
Oh,
we got a lot of students who want questions.
We do have some questions coming in. We have one from Tarika Moore in Orlando, Florida. She wants to know what you recommend to those who are inspired to touch the lives of thousands of people and that want to be successful and share the same testimonies.
Well, first of all, I'd say is recognize there's 6.7 billion people in the world. Nobody just like Tamika's her name?
Yes.
There's nobody just like you, Tamika. Nobody just like you. You're an individual. You're talking directly to you now. That, as Deepak Chopra would say, we're not human beings having a spiritual experience. We are spiritual beings having a human experience. You are special, unique, and God made you an identical twin to yourself. So you are your best partner, and you're your best asset. And when you wake up in the morning, no one can help you more perfectly, and no one can hurt you more beautifully. So figure out what you're passionate about, because you're going to be well, going to do really good at what you're passionate about. And then set off to do that thing like there's nobody's tomorrow. And it won't be a job. It won't be a vocation. It'll be an avocation. And I think finally, find a way to do well and do good. Find a way to do well by doing good. And then to tie in the book, Loss Creates Leaders, nobody woke up in the morning and said, I want to start a cancer foundation. People who start cancer foundations are people whose lives have been impacted by cancer, either because they had it or somebody who they love has had it, somebody who they care about has been impacted by it. So rainbows after storms, loss creates leaders. I am passionate about financial literacy empowerment because my mom and dad divorced over money. Number one cause for divorce in America is money. Number one cause of domestic abuse is money. Black and brown kids drop out of college in America is not academics, it's money. So it's the thing, it's the elephant in the living room that nobody talks about. It's the reason my brother couldn't go to college when my mom wanted to send him, because my dad and mom didn't agree. You know, my dad it sort of showed up with the $4,000 before my mother got there. So that became the reason I got passionate about what I call the new civil rights issue, civil rights, financial literacy empowerment. I think this is the new civil rights issue for our generation. Find something you're passionate about. My vision is to change the world and to eradicate poverty. We serve 1.5 million people, directed $1 billion in inner city, 14,000 Hope Corps volunteers, and I want to double brand, but that started with helping one person. But here's the irony, that one person I ultimately helped was myself. I'm not a philanthropist, I'm certainly not perfect, I'm selfish. This is good selfishness. So what I say to Tamika in summary is good, and this is in the book, good selfishness is where I benefit and everybody else benefits more. Bad selfishness is where I benefit and everybody else pays a price for it. Drug dealing is bad selfishness. Crime and mayhem is bad selfishness. Stealing people's mortgages on Wall Street is bad selfishness. It's winning battles and losing wars. I'd say find a way to practice good selfishness. Raising your child is good selfishness. Working at a nonprofit is good selfishness. The committee is good selfishness. It's doing well and doing good and doing well by doing good. And you'll sleep well at night.
Great. You've accomplished so much. Carol Judson in Seattle, Washington, wants to know what role education played in your life and in your success. And I'm going to preface it by saying that from reading the book, I know that you had some hard knocks education too.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that's one of the philosophies that we have. Our students understand the idea that learning takes place in many different places and in many different contexts,
mm-hmm.
and that it's learning how to put it all together.
Yep.
That is so valuable.
So here's the irony. I don't have a college degree. I went to 1 year of City College. I got a GED degree out of high school, which Chris Rock calls a good enough diploma. I was distracted by business since I was 10 years of age, and so it was hard for traditional ideas to compete with my practical real-life experience, and I had probably started 100 businesses before I was age 20. Most of them failed, I might add. But I was a serial entrepreneur. Now, oddly enough, everybody who works for me has a college degree. I won't hire somebody who doesn't have a college degree. I think an expert is somebody who knows more and more about less and less. I want experts in various aspects of our operations so I can rely on them to add value to what we're doing. I bring a bit of special sauce to the equation, which are my ideas and my passion, my ability to charge a hill and follow up on it with a second turn and so on and so forth. And to be relentless. And so I know where I fit, and my team together, we form a perfect sort of orchestra. Education, though, as I look back on my life, education and unconditional love were two things that, and mentors, I think those are three things that define me. I remember in my elementary school, I remember teachers who believed in me. My mother was laid off from McDonnell Douglas Aircraft and started her own nursery so she could spend time with me. My mother went to go work at my elementary school as a janitor, and she was overly qualified so that she could be with her child. I mean, this is just it just one, it brings tears to me how much she sacrificed for my education. So, and by the time I was in junior high school, my little personality was formed. By the time I was 10 years of age, I had already run into a banker who came into my classroom because the teacher was a value-added teacher, so they wanted to have all these experiences. I remember asking this white, I'm saying this for a reason, this Caucasian banker. I remember asking this white banker with a red tie, a white shirt, and a blue suit, "Man, what do you do for a living and how do you get rich legally?" I mean, I wonder, I said, "I've never seen a white man in the hood other than a detective. Who are you?" And he started explaining to me the language of money and unpacking financial literacy. And I'm like, man, the endorphins started firing. And capital comes from the Latin word capitas, knowledge in the head. So, ideas started firing about what I could do and who I can be. And that combined with seeing my father as an entrepreneur was when I decided to be a businessman. My mother told me she loved me every day of my life. So it was both real life education, most impacted by the time I was, your personality forms by the time you're 13 or 14, your virtues, your values. By that time, I was a young adult. And then combined with my mother telling me she loved me every day of my life, so I had no problem. And then it's not a huge one. And then my dad give me a sense of yes, I can. That's why I think that family structure is so important, and I think that education is the ultimate poverty eradication tool, because when you know better, you do better. If we don't get this education thing straight in the U.S., we'll all be speaking Mandarin in 10 years. I'm slightly exaggerating, but to make a point that this is global competitiveness, and America has to recommit to some basics. I mean, we can do this. We have done it before. We can lead again, but we've got to make smart sexy again. We've been making dumb sexy for too long. For the last 20 years, we've been making dumb sexy. We've dumbed down and celebrated it. We've got to make smart sexy again. And that's why I love what you're doing. Why I love questions like come at us from your students.
Yes,
I told you it's going to give you
important.
sound bites, didn't
Yeah.
I? Okay, I'll remember that.
I will remember that.
Keep me
It's
honest, audience.
when you say the importance of what we're doing, I think that we all, as we pursue our education, think of education as being something that's very personal. But education is really one of the most important strategic issues that the United States faces today.
Sure.
And so I think you really speak a very important truth when
But
you
let me
talk
let, but
about
let
that.
me say let me come at this in a different way. I actually admire. I mean, it goes without saying that you provide a quality education and all. Like, I have a dear friend who finished your courses and got an MBA and just loves you guys and sings your praises. But I don't actually. I'm not leadership, too. And I think we got more credibility from responding in that way than if it had never happened to begin with. I think you grow from these challenges and become stronger individuals, more authentic leaders, and people say, "Wow, I can trust that institution."
Right.
Everything else will be brief.
I know you better than
Yeah. Talking to me is like getting a glass of water out of a fire hydrant
that. Okay, well, let's get to some of
something.
our questions, our viewer questions. We do have quite a few of them. Dan Little from Woonsocket, Rhode Island, asks, it's a very personal question, but I think it's common to many of our viewers, I'll bet. What words of encouragement would you give to a new student who's getting a late start in life? This gentleman is 48 years old and just now starting college.
Beautiful. Most people don't do a thing until they're 50. Moses didn't know what he was doing until he was 80. My hero, Andrew Young, is 79, man. Years Young is 100 honorary doctorate degrees, brought the Olympic Games to Atlanta, mayor 2 terms, congressman 2 terms. But a lot of, and of course, Dr. King's aid in the civil rights movement, but most of what he did came after he was 50. Quincy Jones is 78 years young. And just had some headphones come out, a new album and a book. Nelson Mandela really didn't get into his rhythm till he was in his 70s. You really look at it, and 50 is your new 40. 40 is your new 30. And this generation's going to live to 100. So he's got the benefit of the wisdom of ages while still being young enough to pick up some grandchildren, maybe even a child, his own, and rebirth himself into a new career and a new life, and he has a 60-year run. So I think that this whole concept of retiring when you're 65, maybe in another program we can talk about reimagining the American idea, because I think that you should retire, you should rewire. I think that somebody without a purpose dies. I think that you should have a purpose in your life always. I think that this concept of retirement, which was a political answer after the Great Depression, way to create jobs after the Great Depression, it was to encourage people to retire so that an 18-year-old could get a job that the person who used to work to 80 had. Now they left, they started working at 65, and the 18-year-old began to work in its place. It was a political answer to no jobs after the Great Depression. We've turned it into a multi-billion, $100 billion industry, and people just think that their life is over. And I think that this gentleman's life has just begun. Embrace it with all your gusto. My mother went back to high school at age 62, got her high school equivalency. She's going to kill me for saying it. I was so proud of her, actually. So I would just tell him that this is a great time to start.
I'd agree. I think it's never too late. Lifelong learners.
That's it.
That's what we want to see.
That's it.
This is a great question from Yamira Lee Marshani. I hope I said that right, in Orlando, Florida. She asks, how do you measure the success of your financial literacy programs, and how do you choose a region in which to provide those programs?
Let me start with the second question first.
Okay.
We don't pick regions, they pick us. I don't, and I think it's rude to invite myself into your home to rearrange your furniture and put my feet up as if I'm comfortable. That's rude. It's your home. If you're in Orlando or you are in Fort Lauderdale or Miami, I just met with the mayor of Miami County yesterday, and he invited us to come into Miami, and we said we'd be honored to. We'll work with Wells Fargo and SunTrust and others here, but we have to be invited. So we're in 70 urban markets in America. We're in Haiti, South Africa, Morocco, and a few other places. But in every instance, we were invited. So we think global, but we act local. We make big bets, but we keep very small promises. And that way, we're never considered an outsider. Whenever we come in, we're a local partner. The first question is, I think, how do we measure financial literacy? So I'm very practical. I believe in converting check cashing customers into banking customers, renters into homeowners, small business owners. The guy who made this suit is an Operation Hope success story. His name is Ryan Taylor, no pun intended, Taylor. He came in with a vision to be an entrepreneur. Nobody would listen to him. Nobody would give him a time of day. He wanted a $10,000 loan. We tried to convince him it wasn't about money, but it's a free country. When you light yourself on fire, it's your choice. So we gave him the loan, and he blew it. And he finally came back and said, okay, now I'll listen. And so, fine, you got to pay back the $10,000 loan, go into financial literacy training, case management, and create a business plan. We took out another $35,000 loan 18 months later, raised his credit score 100 points. Now the guy's doing $800,000 a year plus in revenue. Over the last 9 years, he has 6 employees. He's paying his taxes, raising his children, and now started a nonprofit in South Central to teach entrepreneurship. So this is how I measure. It's a cool suit too, ain't
It is a
it?
cool
Even
suit.
makes me look
I'm a
okay.
little jealous.
But that's how we measure his results. We've
Uh-huh.
Funded around $400 million in loans, structured another $400 million in prime mortgages, another couple $100 million in financial literacy training for children. We can train a child for about $50 at Operation Hope in financial dignity, checking, savings, credit, investment, history of banking. And finally, we've entered into a partnership with Gallup, a best in class. So we have the Gallup Hope Financial Literacy Index that is basically behavioral economics for children. So it's financial literacy, hope, well-being, and engagement. And we think we can actually impact the high school dropout rate in America by turning young people into entrepreneurs and job creation factories.
Right. Sounds like a great solution to me.
Well, we're working at it.
Yeah, and doing a great job. I love this question. This is from Lisa Leiter in Kearney, Nebraska. And she talks about the importance of using positive, love-based leadership skills and how important they are, as you talk about. She's asking, can you give us some direction for dealing with leaders who use fear instead of love in directing their company?
Yeah, they'll fail. Countrywide failed. Lehman Brothers failed. Ameriquest Mortgage failed. They'll have their little 15 minutes, but they'll fail. Let me give you a very quick, and I love Lisa Leiter's a great, great name, and I'll be in Nebraska, by the way, in a few gallop. But here's a great love leadership example, very quick. So Mr. Jerk is the employer. Mr. Jerk talks to Tom and says, Tom, look, I don't care. I just got here at this company. I don't care about you or what you believe. You do this job. If you don't do it right, I'm going to fire you. You hear me? I'm going to fire you. Now, you've got a mortgage. You've got kids. And you're, in all practicality, not going to walk out of that job. You're going to, in the short term, say, yes, sir, deal with the fear. But you're going to give that employer only minimal compliance. You're just going to do the bare minimum. And if you're honest with yourself, if that employer gives you an opportunity to show that they are a jerk, you're going to help them slip. I mean, you're not going to trip them. I don't mean that physically, but if they screw up in some way, you wouldn't feel bad about exposing them to their boss if they screwed up. So it's an environment of mutual sabotage. Let's flip it now. Now your boss is Mr. Nice Guy. Hey, Tom, I'm new here. I don't know much about the company. I really need you to help me to learn. You've been here for 19 years. Great record. I have an open door policy. 2 months later, he comes to you. Hey, Tom, come see me sometimes. About a month later, you lose somebody in your family. Hey, Tom, I'm really hurt. Really sorry about your loss. You need to take some time off and go deal with your grieving. Just know that the company is here for you. The question would be, what's happening between you now and Mr. Nice? You're building a relationship. Is that right?
Yes.
So now Mr. Nice asks you on a Friday afternoon at 5 o'clock. Tom, I'm really sorry to ask you about this. I got this important project. It's due Monday. It's very important to the company. I don't want to ask anybody else, but I'm afraid to ask you. You deserve your weekend. I really would love you to do this, but I can't demand that you do it. Only if you are interested do you take on the task.
Sure. You take on the task? Yeah, absolutely.
You do. And do you stay late on Friday?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm asking Lisa Leiter, too. She's probably nodding her head. Do you work on the weekend?
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Do you work until you can deliver that on the Monday morning? The answer, every time I ask a question. Yes, that's above the line value-added leadership. That's excellence. So so treating somebody like a relationship and not as a transaction, treating somebody with respect and dignity is not only the right thing to do, it gives you above the line performance from your employees, and it creates a relationship and esprit de corps and buy-in from everybody involved. So that's just a sort of a quick example of how fear-based leaders, they may win for the day, but they will lose. They may win the battle, but they will lose the war.
So if somebody works for Mr. Jerk, the fear-based leader, does the employee look elsewhere? Do they try to escape from that situation?
You'll see a lot of turnover. You'll see a lot. As soon as the person can get out, they will. You'll see a lot of turnover in that company. My senior management team. Now, by the way, this is a slight amendment. I used to be, one could have argued that I was, and I say this in the book, that I was a version of Mr. Jerk. That I used to stand on tables and scream at the top of my lungs. I mean, the stories I could tell you about Operation Hope in its formative years when we were moving, growing at 100 miles an hour with our hair on fire. That's why, and how I didn't respond so nicely sometimes, but the people knew that I was authentic. They knew I meant well. I may have been immature in my response, but they knew I cared. And authenticity is so incredibly important. People can feel it. They can discern it. They know it. And so they knew John he didn't respond that well, but he believed. So I have very little turnover is my point. You'll start to see in these companies massive levels of turnover at all levels of the organization and sabotage. I think it sort of solves itself. And I think that companies that treat people well, people, there's a stickiness. People want to stick around at those companies, even though the compensation may not be the highest in the market. We're a nonprofit. We don't have stock options. But my average tenure of my senior management team is 10 years. Not bad.
Wow.
And we push them hard. We push people hard to deliver on behalf of the poor and the underserved. Don't worry about
That's
Mr.
great.
Jerk. He or she will
He'll
light
take
himself
care of
up. He'll take
himself,
care of
huh?
himself.
Yeah. We have an interesting question. It sounds like it may be from a faculty member. Rosalie Schwartz, who is in Southeast Florida, asks, how can a college professor engage domestic and international students on an emotional level, as well as becoming involved in leadership? And before you answer this question, I just want to share with our viewers that John, well, I should go back a little further. Last fall, I read John's book and was so very moved by it that I called him and asked him if he would serve on the advisory board for the business school, and he very graciously agreed. And at this time, we have a team of faculty that are working on implementing many of the principles from the Love Leadership book into our curriculum so that our business school students will be inspired by the ideas that John has shared in the book. And so, one of the ways that we will try to help inspire students with the principles of Love Leadership is by sharing it with them in the curriculum. But having said that, it is so very, very important that our faculty embrace ideas that will inspire their students. And I don't want to limit it to just Love Leadership. There are
Sure.
so many ways that a faculty member can inspire their students. But do you have any suggestions for how, especially in this setting where we're online, we have domestic and international
Yeah.
students, how does a faculty member get those people fired up?
So Andrew Young, my mentor I mentioned earlier, Dr. King's aide in the civil rights movement, this living icon, can't get his own children to pay any attention to him. Okay. He knows that if he tells his son, Bo Young, who is a very successful entrepreneur today, if he tells his son, you should marry that girl over there, Bo's going the opposite direction. Okay? It is oftentimes an outside. So he's got to let Bo do his thing. Bo is his nickname. It's an outside. I became sort of Bo's surrogate older brother. So I could say the exact same thing that Ambassador Young is saying. And but I will be validated in a way that this icon can't with his own child. That's something I think that most people watching, if you're parents, you can relate to. So I think that the faculty members are sort of the same thing with their students. Familiarity breeds a little contempt. So you need to maybe introduce an online advocate from the outside. Get a CEO, a former Kaplan alumni who's been successful, or somebody that can bring in, even if it's through video, and have them talk to the student from their own experience to give a more emotional reaction to their successes and their failures, in particular the failures. When I took Federal Reserve Chairman Greenspan into a classroom in the inner city, he said, well, he was going to prepare a speech. I said, Mr. Chairman, please put that speech down. I had to say it very delicately. He was the Fed chairman. And I said, sir, these young black kids in your city think you're an old rich white man that they can't relate to. I say, I got 45 minutes to create a bond, and that speech is not going to help. You're going to put them to sleep. He says, what do I do? I said, tell them stories. Tell them about how you learned statistics through baseball cards. Tell them about how you were on the band in Juilliard, how you wanted to be an orchestra. And you were good, but you weren't great. You ended up doing the accounting for the band members, and that's how you got into economics and finance. And he said, how did you know this about me? I said, because I'm curious and I'm interested in you. So he told the kids his personal story, and the kids lit up and they bonded. So much so that I called him an honorary black man. Anyway, so another story. But my point is use humor, use anecdotes, use stories, but most of all, try to bring an outside mentor, role model. The book, The Tipping Point, Malcolm Gladwell, proves that at 5% role models, any community, it's extremely important, not 50% role models. Just 5%. People reflect, respect, and understand what they see. And so I'd say give them something interesting and compelling to see that makes the case.
And it sounds like also give of yourself, share yourself with
Yes.
your students if you want to inspire them
Something
to
other
that.
than your perceived perfection.
Right, the real
Right.
self,
That's right.
the
I
real.
tell people all the time, I bounce checks. My credit was toe up from the flow up. I mean, my credit was so bad it wasn't credit, it was credit. I had bad credit. But then your audience can relate to you. First of all, again, as I said, nobody's perfect. Everybody knows everybody makes mistakes. The question is not whether you made a mistake, but how you respond to it. Life is 10% what life does to you, and 90% how you choose to respond to it. People are waiting for your response. response. And you look at most crises in the world, the Watergate break-ins was not about the break-ins, it was about the cover-up to the break-ins.
True.
The man I admired very dearly, Bill Clinton, I admire him very dearly. It really wasn't about the scandal itself, but some of the perceptions of how that scandal was handled. And you can go on and on and on. So I think just be honest with your, show them a little bit of your vulnerability, because it's in the book, Vulnerability is Power. I think that by me sharing a little bit of myself with your audience that may not be perceived, it's not on my resume, it's about some of my failures, they are more relaxed, they're more open. Maybe they're more vulnerable in the questions that they ask, and maybe the way they'll be in turn be more vulnerable to their children.
What a perfect setup for our next question. This is great.
That was a way of saying, John, shut up.
Yeah. No, but it is a perfect feed in this. Holly Johnson in Farmville, Virginia is asking, says, I agree that we're our own worst enemies. What has inspired you to look beyond that?
Well, I didn't want to get, like, I mean, this is a straight ahead program, but I can't only answer that one way. I'm God's child. I mean, God doesn't make dirt. God, everybody is unique, special, and beautiful. Everybody has potential to change the world. So with all of my limitations and issues, that's why I don't mind mentioning all those other things, because I'm also God's child, which makes me gives me the potential to be great. And my mission has always been in my life to get out of my own way. The thing I'm most proud of is that I'm reasonably comfortable in my own skin. So for the last 20 years, my friends have been trying to get rich. I've been trying to become wealthy. Difference. Riches is outside on, where wealth is inside out. And so if I don't like me, I'm not going to like you. If I don't feel good about me, I'll never feel good about you. If I don't respect me, I don't have a clue how to respect you. If I don't love me, I don't know how to love you. And hurt people hurt people. Hurt people hurt people. So, I can forgive other people because I need to be forgiven myself. I can have compassion for others because I need compassion. Now, I am impatient with incompetence. I'm impatient with laziness, and I'm working on it. But anybody trying, really trying, I've got the patience of Job with those people, and I think the world does too. So I would tell this person not to be so hard on themselves. Cut himself a break. And then hold himself to high standards.
Good idea.
That was shorter.
That was. That was. We have a question from Carol Judson in Salt Lake City. And I'll paraphrase here. Is there anyone that really embodies principles of love leadership completely? And if so, why?
Yes. Again, love leadership is not about perfection. This is something I'm continuing to battle. And please don't think I'm perfect, because you'd be sorely disappointed. I like being human. A friend of mine in Vienna told me that the greatest sin is not to do bad. All men will do bad, thus all men will sin. The greatest sin in the world is not to do good when you could. So then I would have to flip that and say, who do I believe does good when they could? Saint is a sinner that got up. So you can make a mistake and not be a mistake. Who are those people? I think Jimmy Carter is a great love leader. So he had this challenged presidency. And think about presidents who were perceived to be very successful. Ronald Reagan, as an example, he left office and gave a couple of speeches and basically retired. But look at Bill Clinton, who had a blemish on his presidency. Look at Jimmy Carter, a blemish on his presidency. These guys are changing the world post-presidency. In part, rainbows after storms, loss creates leaders, in part to compensate for the perception that their presidency had some challenges. They are working triple time post-presidency to repair those sins, but also because that's who they are, and they want an expression for their true excellence. They've changed the world. Jimmy Carter has basically eradicated guinea worm in the world. Bill Clinton has spawned, through Clinton Global Initiative, hundreds of billions of dollars that would not have otherwise been dispersed to empower the poor. Andrew Young, I've already mentioned. I'd love to give an example of how he's done that if I get a moment. Actually, makes money through Andrew Young is a great example. Quincy Jones, Bill George, CEO of Medtronics, former CEO of Medtronics, who grew it from $3 billion market cap to $35 billion market cap, and gave 60% of his income to his foundation, where him and his wife Penny now give back to community and is doing extraordinarily Well, I mean, Bill would say, "How many yachts do I need?" sort of a thing. But I mean, I can go on. Luckily, I can. Dr. Dorothy Height, who's since passed. We need more women examples. I think there are countless examples, frankly, if you're willing to look for them, of people who embody these principles. I would say to your, I'd say to your the listener, think of people you admire. Snapshot it in your mind. They're all love leaders. They don't spend a minute of their time dogging somebody, talking down to them, chasing them down with criticism. They're about what they're for, not what they're against. They're committed to doing well and doing good and not just doing for themselves. It's about we and not about me. It's about what they have to give and not just what they have to get. It's about building wealth and not just getting rich. It's about building long-term wealth and sustainability and not just getting paid now. These are consistent themes amongst great leaders.
One of the things I always used to tell my students when I was teaching, one of the things I used to stress to my students is that when we're faced with that opportunity to do something positive or even great, that often the door is only open for a few moments, and we have to know how we choose to react to those things, and that one of the important things we must do is reflect on the kind of person we really want to be, so that when those opportunities present themselves to do good or to screw up,
Yes.
that we've already thought through how the kind of person we want to be, so that we react appropriately the way we want to react to a situation like that. What do you say to that? Do you think that people instinctively do the right thing, or do you think people need to know themselves, come to know themselves to be able to react appropriately to crises or difficult
This is one of
situations?
the best questions, Tom, that anybody's ever asked. Ever. I hate simple questions. This is, I think that it's both, that we are born for good and we learn bad, that badness is nothing more than failed goodness, that it takes so little hope to turn any situation around. One positive person in on your faculty, one positive person on your one of your listeners' block, one positive person in the schoolhouse or in your family can flip an entire negative situation and make it positive. So hope is so powerful, you need a minority of it, even a super minority of it, to change the world. That's what makes me so hopeful, is that even darkness can't be defined except through the prism of light. Light defines and give darkness its strength. So, and for those who are spiritual, I'd say that Lucifer is a fallen angel. He's a punk. God gives him permission to exist. So hope is that incredibly powerful. I think the other side of that, though, is that I've been spending the last 20 years trying to figure out who I am. The constant process, becoming reasonably comfortable in your own skin. And at the end of the day, that's the so we're born for good, but society has hijacked, in many ways, our culture. For 100 years, America was excited about an idea, Tom, whether it was the Kaplan schools, the Kaplan Business School, whether it was another business school, whether it was Walmart or whether it was a World Economic Forum by my friend Klaus Schwab in Switzerland, whether it was Gandhi and his movement, whether it was a social movement or a company, it was all an idea. Ted Turner, CNN, Steve Jobs, Apple, fired from his own company, I might add. Took him 20 years to come back and lead again. And we have gone from the power of the idea, with the byproduct being money, power, and position in the world, to making the byproduct product. Now if you ask people, what are you passionate about? I want to make money. Why are you a rap star? I want to get paid. Why are you an NBA star? I want to get paid. Why are you on Wall Street? I want to get paid. Why are you selling drugs on your street? I want to get paid. It's the only way the drug dealer on your street and the pimp on Wall Street is the same guy. So we've been hijacked by thug culture. We've been overrun with this obsession with money and short-termism and fear-based leadership. But I think that we're tired of it. And I think that going back to what I really said, your core, you know what's right. But there's so much social pressure to do what's wrong. Bill Clinton once said, "It is hard to get people to agree to the truth when the lie is paying their paycheck." So Madoff was able to do what he was able to do because he was hiding in plain sight. He was operating in a culture where we all sort of gradually endorsed it. It's going to take a new generation of young people, kids that are coming up in your business school, who will come and say, "I don't want to do it that way anymore. I want a new way to lead in a fear-based world." And that is a relearned culture. This is a crisis of virtues and values, Tom, and not just an economic crisis. And in that way, the crisis has saved us from ourselves.
Great answer. Simeon Snow asks, and this is a good question. This is another tough one. Mm. Since you said you like tough questions.
I love them.
In promoting financial literacy, do you believe that a majority of the people in poor economic conditions are plagued by social programs such as food stamps? Or do they use those programs to get ahead?
I think that anybody who believes that poor people are pimping food stamps is a little needs to be trained a little bit about what real pimping is. I mean, ain't on purpose. Ain't nobody I know pimping food stamps. I think that there are people seriously now who are taking advantage of the system, gaming a system. I think that the system for as welfare, designed to be a springboard for people in bad times, and in many cases became a mattress. So versus giving people a bridge over troubled water, it became a lake that people fell asleep on. That's not a good thing. You want to give people a hand up, not a handout. And you can create any kind of culture you want. When Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was in Israel with Andrew Young and his wife Coretta Scott King, and Coretta Scott King is another unheralded shero, I might add. But to make a long story short, he was on the Jericho Road, and a reporter said, "You remind me of the Good Samaritan on the Jericho Road." And King said nothing. Later, Andrew Young said, "Why didn't you answer the reporter?" He said, "Andy," called him Andy. "Andy, I respect the Good Samaritan. I love the Good Samaritans. But that Jericho Road is dangerous. It's got blind corners. It's got blind spots. It's got dangerous portions of that road. That road needs to be repaired." He said, "Andy, I don't want to be the Good Samaritan on the Jericho Road. I want to repair the Jericho Road. I want to fix the Jericho Road. I want to build the Jericho Road. Home ownership, small business ownership, and empowerment." So financial literacy is a problem for all Americans, but when mainstream America has a headache, black and brown folks have pneumonia. It's worse when you're poor. This crisis is a middle-class crisis, not a poor person's crisis. Poor people don't have $20 trillion to lose. These are middle-class folks with college degrees who asked what was the payment when they got a mortgage, not what was the interest rate. Never ask what the payment is when there's an interest rate attached. Just when you're living in an inner city, you got that problem, plus you got low self-esteem, a sense of spiritual, emotional, psychological poverty, no role models, and then people who are preying on you, like check cashers, rent-to-own stores, and so forth. So I think that what we need is a movement in low-wealth communities around what I call silver rights. Free enterprise and capitalism work for the poor. The reason I think it'll work is because the middle class is hurting today too. If you're middle class today, you're probably living from paycheck to paycheck. I mean, if you're making less than $70,000 a year in New York, or $50,000 a year in a Miami, or $35,000 a year in a small city in Nebraska, you're struggling to make ends meet. So it's not about white, black, red, brown, or yellow. It's about, I want some more green. We're all in this together. That was intentionally a long answer, by the way.
Yes. Well, I think we have time for one more question. What advice would you give to a middle-aged person that's lost their job and are having no luck finding a new one? Obviously, this is a very difficult economy in which to find a job, and don't have the funds or the time to start a new career. What would you do?
I don't understand when somebody says, "I don't have the funds or the time to start a new career." I've been doing so much with so little for so long, I can almost do anything with nothing. When people who are my friends tell me about their problems, I say, those are high class problems. It could be in Haiti. It could be in Sudan. It could be a woman in Saudi Arabia who needs a note from her husband to drive a car to the grocery store. Those are real problems. What we have are inconveniences. And I think when people say they don't have time, what they're really saying is it's not important. Because if you're told that you won the lottery and you got to be in the Florida State Capitol tomorrow at 4 o'clock, and it's $1 million waiting for you, my guess is you'll find a way to be there. I think we make time for that which is important. And I just think that we've got to prioritize. We talked about earlier about having a strategy. You need a life strategy. You've got a strategy for your business. You've got a strategy for what else you do. Have a strategy for your life. Vision. Mission, purpose, plan, tactics. That's where your degree comes in. Tactics, to-dos, to-dones, assessment, evaluation, reset, reboot, reimagination, back up to vision 2.0. And that's a process I go through I mean, frankly, I do it on a daily basis, but I think you should do it. Never give up. Never sell yourself short. Take the words can't and impossible out of your dictionary. Love is work. Non-love is laziness. Anti-love is evil. Very little human evil in this world exists. It exists. Most people are just lazy, emotionally lazy, financially lazy, psychologically lazy, spiritually lazy. They just don't want to do the work. And worse, want somebody else to do it for them. Love is work. Nothing good comes without work and sacrifice. So I'll end with this quote. Scott Peck has a chapter in his book, the first chapter of his book, The Road Less Traveled. First line, first sentence, first page, 25-year bestseller. Life is difficult. Translation. If you can't get with that statement, don't read the rest of the book, because nobody promised you a rose garden. Nobody said that life was going to be free of grief or pain. When you can embrace your pain and learn how to live through legitimate suffering, you're free. And that's whether you're poor or whether you're rich. I mean, your economic standing means nothing. Some of the most honorable people I've ever met are those who are so-called poor.
But only by someone else's definition.
Then that's another topic for another show.
It is, and that would be a great one. We'll have to do that. Well, I'm afraid that's about all the time we have. I want to thank you, John, for joining us tonight and being such a great guest. And we so appreciate your time, your insight, and your willingness to attend this, our